At Real Metrics, we collect and analyze a ton of slot data, and we're hit up frequently for insights, tips, and tricks. So we decided to do a webcast in which we present, discuss, and otherwise nerd out on our work. Coming to you from our offices in lovely Leiden, the Netherlands, welcome to Realcast. Good morning, Don. How are things near? And this is a St. Louis nickname I picked up over the weekend, the chess capital of the world.
It's very true. It's a beautiful late winter day, a little breezy today. We had winds like 50 miles an hour today, but we are definitely the chess city of the world. The Chess Hall of Fame is located in St. Louis.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of major tournaments that are held in St. Louis, and the collegiate champions have been from St. Louis for years. So it is definitely a big chess town.
Yeah, what I was reading that there's a Missouri billionaire in his 70s. He goes by the name of Tyrannosaurus Rex. Have you ever heard of this dude?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Rex, so he's apparently obsessed with the game and has poured tens of millions of dollars into the sport locally. So there are three local universities now that offer full-ride chess scholarships. Webster even has an institute that's headed by a grandmaster. And there are now after-school chess programs at more than 100 local schools. So quite a quite a factoid to pick up. And here's the kicker, Don. I checked this morning, and you can bet on chess. So,
really?
Yeah. So if you're looking for a new hobby, you won't have to drive far to handicap the next generation of chess champions, I guess.
I've been on a lot of things in my life, but never chess.
Okay. Yeah. My kids did it for a while, but then they got bored. So I guess I kind of went the same direction as a kid, but oh well.
My dad taught me how to play chess when I was 6 years old.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you've been at it for a long time, but the bug never really truly bit you.
Yeah. I go for years without playing a game, but thankfully in the age of computers, you can now play games online versus back in the day, I was playing games by mail.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. You have a postcard and you'd make your moves via postcard.
Oh, wow. Okay. So like you'd make a move every 5 days or something like that.
Pretty much.
Okay. All right. Well, I thought today, Don, and let's see, is our second episode of the second season. So I thought we could just kind of dive right in during the intro this morning and address a couple of listener questions. We had quite a few interesting queries float in during the last month. So I thought it'd be nice to touch upon two of them. So the first comes from a listener in the American Northeast, who says, "Hi guys, love the best practices episode. During the setup, Nick stated that marketing should have a seat at the table as it pertains to inventory management, but I don't believe you guys expanded upon this. So can you provide a bit more detail?" So first, many thanks for the question. It's a great one. Now in addressing it, what I'd say is it's first important to explore a little bit marketing's traditional role within gaming organizations. And I'm not saying that this is universal, but it's certainly quite widespread. And it's this notion that marketing's job is to bring people into the venue and it's operations job to give them reason to come back. And so as such, marketing traditionally within gaming has focused more on the marketing communications side of the equation. So these are ad buys, email marketing, snail mail marketing, promotions, et cetera. While operations has been the organization really focused on the product marketing. So the selection, pricing, placement, promotion of whatever we place on our quote unquote shelves. Now, we call our best practices stack demand-driven inventory management, or DDIM, for a reason. And that is that everything, so all critical slot decisions are based on evidentiary demand. And you get to that evidentiary demand by analyzing player data in exhaustive detail. And the department that typically manages these data sets and is most experienced in, with mining them is marketing. Yet, when we look at soft polls, when we go out and we're talking to gaming organizations, what we see is that marketing almost never has a role in the inventory management within gaming organizations. And in fact, in a disturbingly large number of organizations, there are actually policies in place which prohibit marketing from sharing player data with other departments. And as we've discussed, we're not aware of any other retail-oriented industry where marketing is, so isolated from the inventory side of the equation. And when we look at the waste levels in slot product, trust me, this shows. Now, a question is, do we get pushback from operations on marketing's involvement? Initially, yeah, we can. However, when the nuance of what marketing contributions bring to the table start entering the fray, this is when we see that resistance, if there's any there, really start to dissipate. And I'll give you a great example of this nuance. So one of the places where it absolutely shines is in the concentration of player productivity. So when you discuss demand with slot people, they often cite this Pareto principle of, let's say, 20% of the customers generating 80% of the revenue. Fine. I think everybody understands that principle. But in this realm, the devil is very much in the detail, and it's generally marketing that can provide that detail. So first, the top level split is generally a bit closer to, 15% of the players generating, around 85% of the revenue. But more critically, you often see fewer than, let's say, 5% of players generating close to half of all revenue. So who are they? What do they play? When do they play? How do they play? Are we creating any obstacles which impede that play? And most critically, how do our inventory management decisions impact that play? This is where marketing can really provide a lot of incremental detail that's really helpful here. So why involve marketing? Well, first, it's generally marketing and the data over which they preside that's best positioned to help you find reliable, high-resolution answers to such questions. And secondly, modeling to find these answers is typically a multi-step process that requires a lot of collaboration and iterative enhancement. So player data is just a very different beast than performance data, and you'll need an open dialogue with experienced staff to truly harness and exploit it. And typically, you can find these folks in marketing departments. And a little shameless plug here, and that is, if you combine this collaboration between operations and marketing with our best practices stack and our Cupid segmentation modeling, you're going to streamline and accelerate this process exponentially. And truly, that's your goal. So by the time your competitors have any idea what you're doing, you want to have a vibrant, well-structured, program up operational, snatching wallet from your competition and spinning off cash. So if you're interested in that, just give us a jingle and we'll walk you through it. But in all this, really, marketing is a core component of making sure that you can really create these vibrant, well-structured programs. So Don, anything you want to add to that with respect to marketing? Have a seat at the table.
Well, we'll dive into some of the best practices using marketing and host level players here in a little bit. The big thing, I guess, would be it's not always easy to pull player data out of the slot information systems. Mm-hmm. You can find machine numbers and length of play and stuff like that, but it's really tough to coordinate what your best players are playing. And that's where marketing has it all together. They can help you run reports that will identify what your best players are playing. So lean on marketing to help find some of these answers that we'll be talking about here shortly.
Okay, great. Okay, and so the second question that I wanted to hit, it was from a listener in the Northern Midwest, and they had asked, in season 2, episode 1, you mentioned a machine doing 6 times house average, and that due to demand, this isn't ideal. So my question is, where's the sweet spot with 1.5x being too low and 6x too high? what's a good mean performance level to target? So again, many thanks for the question. Now, my guidance to this listener was to focus more on target occupancy levels, which we've covered previously. So we generally guide around 65% mean occupancy for your high octane lease games. And then Don, I think it's a little closer to 35% in the core. Is that generally where you guide?
It is.
Okay. So I kind of cautioned him away from targeting specific occupancy levels, but then Don chimed in and said, actually, you can kind of eyeball this. So Don, maybe you can add a bit additional color there.
It has to be a combination of occupancy plus your average against house average. If you're above 4, 4.5, you really should consider adding more units, unless your occupancy levels are really, really low. But that's only happens in casinos that have a very low win per unit per day average, say south of $150, where your lease games are doing so well. They're doing $1,000, but your house average is only $150. You'll see it sometimes there where you'll see a 6x multiple, but the density levels are really, really low. A lot of weekend-driven business. But generally, if you're above 4, 4.5, you really should start considering expanding.
Yeah. Okay. And in terms of, do you have like general thoughts on kind of where they want to shoot in terms of a performance level? Like, is it more that 2.5 to 3, or where do you guide in that way really?
I like to stay in the threes.
Yeah.
Somewhere between 3 and 4 is usually a really nice place. That means you've got a nice variety. You've got enough depth and enough units. Once you get below 3, that gets tough. Then, like you said, once you get above 5, it's really, you're not satisfying your customers. There's a lot of wait. There's a lot of downtime.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Well, many thanks for that, Don. And again, thanks to the listeners who submitted those questions. We really appreciated it. And for everybody else, we'd love to tackle any questions that anybody listening may have. So if you have a question about what we're presenting or something you'd like us to present, please drop us an email at realcast@realmetrics.com. Again, that's REELCAST at realmetrics.com. And as you've heard, our policy is to keep all questions anonymous. So please speak directly and don't worry about us revealing your identity. That is decidedly not our jam. So, Don, here we go. The second part of a multi-part series on updating best practices. So I will turn it over to you and let's get at it.
All right. Let's start with floor size. Especially post-COVID, we've been seeing a lot of floors that are larger than they should be. I guess the first rule of thumb would be if 25% of your floor is getting less than 25,000 handle pulls per month, you probably could pull games without any revenue implications. There's just a lot of obsolete games on the floor, especially once you get down to the low denomination reels. Anything below a dollar per se, that's look at those first. We're seeing a lot of post-COVID play get away from reels. There was a lot of our older customers that did not come back to the casinos, and it's really impacting the win per unit of the low limit reels, especially quarters and pennies. There are just a lot of games on the floor that probably shouldn't be there anymore. So start with those obsolete cabinet removals. Pull them out bank by bank, you know, based upon your revenue and your fair share analysis. That's the best place to start to open up your floor to get to the second phase, which is getting rid of the large banks. Banks of 8 should be split into 2 banks of 4. Banks of 6 should be reduced to packs of 4. Banks along the walls need to be broken up. Try to create as many end games as you can and get rid of as many middle machines as possible. You can utilize carousels whenever you can. They're a space eater, but if you get rid of those machines that are not producing in your floor, you will just make the floor that much more comfortable for all your customers.
So Don, with these big linear banks, that was kind of always the standard, you know, way back when. What would you say is the, just for anybody who's not really familiar with this, why is it that these things are going out of mode?
The revenue that the middle machines produce is so much lower than the end machines, especially if after you get past a six pack, when you start looking at banks of 8, banks of 10, banks of 12, the revenue that the middle machine's producing is so much lower than the end machines.
Sure.
The player comfort factor, especially COVID, has added into it. But even before COVID, their revenue for those machines was super low. And now post-COVID, it's really fallen off a floor. It's something that needs to be looked at most casinos. Now, obviously, if you've got a capacity issue, if your capacity strained during that Thursday through Sunday period, it's a different problem. Mm-hmm. I had times where I was jamming machines into every nook and cranny of my floor as I could just because I needed a space. But most casinos aren't in that world anymore, and they really need to reduce these bank sizes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll go on to the next step then. Is you start getting to the art form, is trying to build these neighborhoods, trying to examine your top themes by theoretical tiers. What are your themes that your key players are playing? Use that top 50 list and try to start putting banks in the general neighborhood of what your host level players like to play. First, you have to determine, is there a significant crossover between game types? If not, there's no need to place your top 50 units near high limit or near your video poker. Mm-hmm. If your host level players shy away from video poker or there's no crossover play, there's no need to keep them next to each other.
Yep.
But if there is significant crossover play, you need to consider maybe placing your top 50 themes near game types that do crossover, like your dollar reels or your high limit area, your electronic table games, your video poker, things like that. But generally, if there's no crossover play between your host level players and the other game types, you can separate them.
Yep.
Have your own penny area that has your best lease games, your best core games, and keep those players in that neighborhood. And that's where one of the things that I've enjoyed doing the last couple of years with the site is using the location grading to determine the best location for building your neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. Will these themes work in a B location or a D location? Do they have to be in an A location to work? And that ends up being really key when you're building these neighborhoods, because you can put something near a Dragon Link or a Lightning Link or a Buffalo Link bank and pick up the pace on those games. But what happens when you separate them? Are you going to lose revenue per day? Are they going to be fined someplace else? So you really have to use that art form of trying to figure out what banks need to go next to which banks. And the only way you can do that is looking to figure out where the crossover play is. And then you start tiering it. What themes are that $150 to $300 ADT players playing? Is it different than your host level players? Can you build a neighborhood for them? What themes are your low theoretical players playing? Like I said earlier, it's mostly going to be your obsolete cabinets, your older themes, and you can definitely group those together. And most casinos do. Mm-hmm. Most of the casinos will put their obsolete games next to obsolete games. There are some cases where you can put some of those older cabinets in a preferred location because your host level players will pound some of those older cabinets, but it's usually not their first choice.
Right.
And then the next thing is you start looking at things like, what player segment is playing your electronic table games? Is it table games players? Is it predominantly slot players? And based on those findings, your electronic table games either should or shouldn't be near your table games. If it's a lot of table games crossover played, put it close. If it's mostly slot players that are playing it, you don't have to put your electronic table games near slots. You'll see a lot of electronic table games near sports books now. And that's been a pretty successful crossover. And then same thing goes with your video poker players. If there's no crossover play with your best players, you can afford to put your video poker in a C, D, or F location on your floor. But if there is solid crossover play with your best players, you probably shouldn't put them any worse than a C location. There are some revenue impacts by putting your video poker in a better location. I've done it everywhere from an A location to an F location, and there usually ends up being about a 10 to 20% difference in revenue just because of the convenience factor of having video poker in a better location.
And Don, with that, with the ETG and poker crossover and slots, what are you finding generally that this is like massively variable by like changes in demographics or things of this nature? What are you really seeing in terms of crossover with those game types?
It's kind of been surprising. It is definitely a younger crowd that's playing them. Mm-hmm. You're seeing a lot of play under the age of 45 playing electronic table games. You're not seeing a whole lot of crossover play between electronic table games and slots. Mm-hmm. There are players who play ETGs only. But the biggest, I guess, finding I've seen so far is the number of players, younger players, who are playing slot machines more so than I thought they would.
Yeah.
I figured it would be the younger players would be gravitating towards the social games, the blackjack, craps, roulette, and they are spending the vast majority of their theoretical on slot machines, yeah. Both men and women. And it kind of goes against what we've kind of figured for the last decade or so, is that the younger players are looking for those social aspects of the games, but they're not. They are playing slots and they're playing specific slot machines.
Yeah.
So I guess the next thing we want to talk about on the best practices is when you need to expand your current selection versus when you should buy new. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things is just making sure that your themes that resonate with your host level players, that you have enough of them. What's at high occupancy that you can't get enough of with conversions? Do you have certain cabinet shortages? Are all your themes on your banks at 1.2 times house or better on your core games? If so, you might want to consider expanding some of these cabinets, especially if they're fairly new construction games that have been out in the last 2 years or so. If all themes are over 1.5 times house average on your bank, you definitely need to start looking at expansion for these games, especially if they are host level player specific games. You need to make sure you have enough of the new themes that are out there that are doing really well. And there's some core games out there that have been introduced in the last 2 years that are still doing 2 times, 2.5 times, now 3 times house average on some of these core games. And there's just not enough of them out there for your host level players.
Yeah.
So look at all your game types and denominations. A lot of your action gaming themes can be expanded. A lot of your high worth core games can be expanded, especially in cabinets that were introduced in the last 2 years. And the other big thing is you really need to start looking at video units above pennies for expansion. Mm-hmm. The host level players will pound these games. We're seeing insane average bets on some of these units, north of $10 per spin on nickels and dimes, and it actually creates occupancy pluses for you because a lot of your players will not sit on those games because of the average bet. So it opens up play opportunities for your host level players who will play up. And there's a lot of games out there, both classics and new, that are doing really well at 5 cents and 10 cents.
Yeah.
Beyond the lease games.
Now, Don, on that point about adding more of stuff that's already working, we've discussed this in the past, that there just kind of seems to be a natural reluctance to do that. That is just replicating themes that are already working, especially on the core side of things. So would your advice to people on this one just be, trust the math on this, and that if you're seeing if the fair share values and the performance values really support it, in addition to your player data, just move on it, right? Because I do encounter a lot of reluctance on that notion of just replicating what's working.
Yeah, there's you have to have that balancing act between refreshing your floor and making sure that your customers have what they want to play on your floor.
Yeah.
Everyone wants the new shiny games, but we know we've talked about in the past that you only have about a 25-30% success rate at mm-hmm. the best yeah. on new themes and new cabinets. Some of the new cabinets that are out there are slam dunks. Don't wait.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff out there that you look at and you say, well, there's no depth to these cabinets. And you might want to consider waiting, if you can, for a few months to see if there's additional themes that come out. But in the meantime, you've got games on your floor that are doing over 2x house average as a core game. You probably have games out there that are doing better than your lease games, and they need to be expanded. There's been a lot of really neat titles the last couple of years, and they need to be expanded. They're packed all the time. So why not consider expanding your successes? Because these games have legs, and they're going to be on your floor for a long time. You've got classic games that have legs that have been on the floor for 7-8 years that you wouldn't even think about getting rid of. And it's going to be the same with these games here.
Yeah. Okay.
So I guess that leads into, you know, when do you buy things that you don't have on your floor? So, you know, if your floor is ready for new cabinets and themes, the first step is a look at that library depth. How many themes are over 1.5x house average in their library? The greater number, the more machines that you can purchase. We've talked about it in the past where some manufacturers have come out with one or two themes, and that was all they ended up with their cabinet.
Yeah.
So once those themes ran their course, you were stuck.
Yeah.
And if they couldn't come up with anything additional, you're stuck with that game for 7 years of low performance. So you really need to look at those libraries and definitely those. Trust the ones that you trust, I guess is the easiest way to say it. Some of the smaller vendors out there have some really neat games, but they are limited in the number of units that they're producing.
Yeah.
If none of the games are over 1.2x house average, you might want to consider passing, because you know within a year or two that those games are all going to be below house average. So it really is about that depth of library. Now, when you're looking at reels and video poker, look for house average or better. That's about what you should expect on a good reel or a good video poker game. I'd look at conversions first before you have new spend. Revenue strength is just not comparable between new video and new reels or new video poker, with very few exceptions. So spend most of your money on that video. That video percentage of revenue keeps climbing, and it's going to be 80% of the revenue before too much longer.
Yeah, clearly.
So the real play continues to decline, even with the addition of the new cabinets this year. They were both really nice cabinets and looked really sharp and play really well. But that percentage of players who plays reels is going down every year, and I just don't see it going up.
And Don, has that been really an aging demographic on physical for some time now? I mean, has that been the overall trend you've seen?
It really is. And between COVID and the introduction of the high performance lease games that your host level players could play a higher average bet, it really started cutting into the lease, into the real play.
Sure.
I remember back about 8 years ago or so, and I started seeing that drift from those dollar real players and the $5 real players to your high performing lease games, because they were playing $5 or spin on these lease games before they couldn't. And that really just accelerated the issue. And then when COVID hit, a lot of those customers just did not come back. It is definitely an older demographic that plays the reels. And as that demographic ages and has less disposable income, you're starting to see that shift.
Yeah. And I know there was a theory out there for a long time that it was, you know, physical reels were far less intimidating to, you know, unsophisticated players. People are just coming in. But, you know, from some of the data that I looked at and some of these studies that we did recently, you know, you didn't really see that. And certainly with the younger people, it didn't look like they were stepping up to a lot of physical reels.
Yeah, it used to be that the video was always intimidating because you had all these choices to make. How many lines, how many coins per line were you going to play? Well, the manufacturers have done a really good job of cleaning that up. And now it's a lot of forced betting to where they're basically just hit the button, just like you do pull a handle on the old reels or hit the button. And it's a lot less intimidating. Yes, there might be 243 ways or 1,000+ lines, but you don't have to know where all the lines are. You just hit the button and know what the results are.
One big fat button.
Yeah, just pick the amount of, that you're comfortable playing, whether it's, you know, 50 cents, $1, $2, $3, and that's all you have to worry about. Just like before on the reels, it was, you know, a quarter machine, you know, you're playing 75 cents, or a dollar machine, you're playing $2 or $3.
Yeah.
And so they've really simplified it, and it's made it a lot easier to play video. You don't have to worry about, okay, I don't know where that 15th line is anymore. You just don't care.
Sure.
So the next part on trying to figure out what you don't have on the floor that you might want, look at smaller banks, especially for new cabinet purchases. Anything released in the last 12 months, you probably want to do 4-packs and 6-packs. Some cabinets just never do find a foothold on your floor, and you're going to have these machines for 10 years with declining performance every year. So I would definitely limit the number of themes per bank and make the bank smaller, especially for some of the smaller vendors out there that you want to have on your floor that you do want to buy versus trial. A bank of 4 should only have 2 themes. A bank of 6 probably should only have 2 themes as well. It makes the themes last longer. It makes the libraries deeper for you. It really does help. And the performance in these banks goes up. We did a study last year with all new bank installations, and the banks that had 1 or 2 themes on them outperformed the banks that had 3 or more. And it wasn't even close.
Yeah.
It was like double.
Yeah, I remember this. It was those numbers were amazing.
Yeah, and we've kind of told that to the smaller manufacturers too, is when you're going out there doing these sales, you don't have to pitch 6 themes on a bank of 6. Pitch your best 1 or 2 themes and watch the performance just rock it up for these themes. And then if they do well, then you can expand your sales. You can expand the number of cabinets you have on your floor. There's just no need to have 6 themes on 6 games or 4 themes on a bank of 8. You know, stick with your high counts of your all-stars and then expand the cabinets if they're doing well.
Yeah, and hearkening back to some of our first episodes, we discussed over diversification and that and the problems that we see there. And, you know, this is another thing where we say, yeah, and the theme count, typically we find, you know, the overriding principle is less is more. Completely contrary to how we were raised in the industry, which is, you know, your variety is a spice of life and you need to hedge your risk, you know. And so that was always what it was about, is distributing that. And we just found, you know, that's not something to live by anymore.
I just looked at 2 new clients' floors over the weekend, and they're doing the same thing as everybody else. It is your top 35 to 50 machines on your floor is doing 50% of your revenue.
Yeah.
There's just a limited number of themes that produce so much that you really don't have to have 500 different themes on your floor. You know, if you've got 1,000 units on your casino floor, you can really limit the number of themes, because that's what the customers want. They want to play the games that they enjoy. And most of the time, you've got a lot of themes out there that people just don't want to play.
Yeah.
So that was about it for the best practices for this episode, Nick. I know we wanted to talk about tracking performance and utilizing performance guarantees and stuff like that in the next episode to wrap up the best practices. But the big thing, the overarching principles here is work with marketing, figure out what your host level players are playing, and make sure you have enough of those games, whether it's lease, whether it's core, and really look at those weekends. If your host level players play on the weekend, you need to make sure that they can have a good experience.
Yeah, I think it's always this dichotomy of, you know, peak occupancy versus mean occupancy, and just making sure you always have those numbers straight.
Yeah, most of your revenue is going to come from that Thursday evening through Sunday evening period, and make sure that you have enough of the good games during that time. You know, and it goes to walking the floor, talking to your casino host players, to seeing what they're playing through, you know, with marketing's help or pulling reports from the information systems, but you've got to have enough of those good games on the weekends.
Yep. Okay. Cool. Well, okay. So thanks for that, Don. And so before we sign off, I wanted to put in another shameless plug. So we have the IGA trade show in San Diego coming up at the end of March. I'm going to be speaking on a panel there about data democratization. It's going to be moderated by the great Buddy Frank, and it will be myself and Grant Stausland, the CEO of SlotCheck. Now, it's going to be in the Tribal Leaders Lounge at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, the 27th of March. So if you're at IGA, please stop by. We'd love to see you. So, Don, with that, I think it's a wrap. So I think it's time for you to jump in the car and get out there and start handicapping some local chess nerds.
I think I'll stick with golf.
There you go. So how many people around the industry have your model now? Is it in the tens or twenties, or is it just really a limited circulation?
For the golf?
Yeah, for your betting model, the golf.
There's more of my fantasy football models out there for some of our clients that have asked for them. And especially some of the previews that I do in like August and all that, some of the rankings, but there's a couple out there that are texting me every week on who to bet on for golf. So it's been a good run. So it's a nice secondary income. So it's something fun.
Well, at least you can make it work. If I bet on anything, it's just a disaster. So
no, but it's been fun. It's makes the weekends enjoyable when you've got a guy in contention.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks again, Don. And until next time.
All right, take care, Nick.
Thank you. Bye-bye.